This serves as both an introduction, conclusion, and outline. So the different styles of dynamo research, some interested in modeling the fields in very specific objects, including many of the details, and often that has involved parameterizing the nonlinear coefficients, the alpha, beta, as we've seen. But another approach is to try to identify the underlying principles in evolution of large-scale fields, and in particular their saturation. That's a problem that has really plagued the physics of understanding of these, particularly in large magnetic Reynolds numbers dynamos in the astrophysical realm, as we've heard Fausto say. Interesting that there's just recently a conference on accretion disk research, and the parallels are really very interesting. In dynamo theory, large-scale dynamo theory, one had the sun. A mean field model was produced with known approximations. Subsequent ability to study nonlinear evolution and back reaction revealed that, you know, the kinematic approach is incomplete. And then a mass essentially of a lot of confusion, a lot of good effort, but the simulations, et cetera, have to be restricted. How do you feed back the information you get from those simulations into a revised mean field model that includes some of this new physics? That's kind of the process which is ongoing. And I think in accretion disk, it's the same thing. You saw emission from quasars. You wanted a mechanism that converts gravitational energy into luminosity, gravitational potential energy. A mean field model, Shakur-Sanayev model, was produced. It allows practical use and practical application. Well, then, of course, the mechanism of angular-momentum transport was unclear. So simulations go at the game and try to understand how the magnetic field couples into that problem. And presently, we're still not in the state in accretion disk theory of coupling back the information learned from those simulations into the generalized mean field theory that is both practical but accommodates some of this nonlinear physics. So it's very interesting. And so I sort of, in general, the theme is, you know, because we see large-scale patterns and properties, there are unifying principles underlying these systems despite their complexity. So the aim is kind of simplicity in my way of thinking about this. And so the question is not, is mean field theory correct, but is it the correct mean field theory, assuming there exists a correct mean field theory that is sort of yet to be determined. Now, an underlying principle in what I'm going to say is that large-scale dynamo theory and what has sometimes called helical dynamo theory, it's magnetic helicity, not kinetic helicity, that is the unifying helicity. And by unifying, I mean that which allows one to best understand the nonlinear evolution of these systems. I'll explain that in more detail. And I say this unifying because there's a range of dynamos in which this principles of tracking this help to understand what's going on. Of course, magnetic helicity is composed of quantities that are in the MHD equation, so you could say that the MHD equations are the unifying principle, which isn't really helpful, but you'll see how this works. So by tracking the magnetic helicity evolution, particularly the small scale buildup, one can understand this saturation. And LSD I'm going to use here, this is not to be confused with the substance that some theorists might accuse their colleagues of using. And I want to explain how this fits, magnetic helicity evolution fits into textbooks, some of the textbook principles that are textbook shortcomings that are missing. And key themes are time evolution, helicity fluxes, and the role of shear. One of the other points that over the years there's been a lot of passionate debate on whether large-scale dynamos, alpha theory, and such work. And one of the themes that I seem to feel is important to point out is that often the debates focus on the interpretation, not on the calculational results. And so sometimes get a result of a simulation, and if you look carefully at the simulation, it may have restrictions which don't make the result incorrect, but make the implication for the broader class of problems more limited. And it's that has sometimes been at the root of disagreement, not the technical disagreement over whether a given calculation as imposed is correct. Okay. And there's a few other points that the classification of dynamos will include dynamos that are both magnetically dominated, as the sort that Kerry Forrest was discussing, in which this is also a relevant unifying principle, as well as the astrophysical large-scale dynamos. And it is interesting in that context that the corona of astrophysical dynamos, the corona of astrophysical rotators, is very much like the interior, the corona now, is much like the interior of a plasma device, in that you're injecting loops of magnetic field with twist, with helicity, and the evolution of the field in the corona is really a direct analogy to the magnetically dominated type of dynamos that go on in plasma devices. So in the big picture, a rotator may actually be coupling a flow-dominated dynamo in the interior with a magnetically dominated dynamo in the corona, in which the field subsequently evolves. And I want to argue that magnetic helicity is a unifying theme in all of the above, and I probably won't get to discussing anything about transient dynamos, which are another type of dynamos that I've been recently thinking about. Hello. It's gonna be here. Totally blank. Try this one. Okay, that'll work. Okay, classification of dynamos. Small-scale dynamos. This is the simplest view graph. We're not going to be discussing. This is a classification. And these are dynamos typically flow-driven. And the key point is that the field in this definition amplified at or below the forcing scale. Little amplification at wave numbers less than the forcing scale. Typically, these are concurrent with any large-scale dynamos that you have that go on. And that has been a source of the one of the how the two dynamos interact has been one of the sources of the studies of research. Now, large-scale dynamos, the electromotive force is essential. And again, I would argue this theme, underlying theme, I can't seem to emphasize it too much, so you will get sick of it after a while. Magnetic helicity, evolution, potentially relevant in understanding all cases. Now, the field here is sustained on time or spatial scales larger than turbulent forcing scales. The common mechanism that one is usually think of as being an ingredient is some kind of global reflection asymmetry, stratification, rotation, either naturally arising or imposed in toy simulations. And if you define flow-driven helical dynamos, which are forced with, say, a kinetic helicity, although that's not the only way to do this, or natural in the sense that you let the asymmetry from the global conditions produce the dynamo coefficients, either a kinetic helicity naturally or not, sheared or unsheared. And then there's this magnetically driven helical dynamo equivalent to dynamical relaxation in lab plasmas and coronae. So those are that. Now, there's also a class of large-scale dynamos emerging recently in some of these simulations, and one can kind of make links to previous work, where you don't actually have a global large-scale reflection asymmetric circumstance, but you're getting fields that, but you typically do have shear. Turbulence and shear seem to be the minimum ingredients, and globally, there's no reflection asymmetry, but locally one may, in principle, understand some kind of effects that when you do local averaging, some of the same principles up here apply down here. I can talk about this in more detail. I want to focus on this first, and you'll see that some of the principles here, when applied locally, kind of may also fit here. But let's move on. So I can skip that. The first, I want to consider these in a series of examples, each of which can be derived from the combination of a magnetic field evolution equation and magnetic helicity evolution. So I will show you this in particular. The magnetic helicity evolution as this form, there's a boundary flux term, there's a resistive term. You can then, through the use of the Maxwell relations, Ohm's law, you can derive them in this form. And these are well known. Now, we'll start with a two-scale picture. The small scale refers to fluctuating quantities, and the bars refer to means. Means suitably defined, contextually dependent on how you define your mean. Important that the electromotive force that we all think of and are used to thinking about enters here. It, when dotted with the mean field, represents a source in the magnetic helicity evolution. There are also other sources. Here is a boundary flux term. There is a dissipation term. Now, this small-scale evolution, the magnetic helicity, it turns out to be needed to understand saturation in a number of cases, and I'll make this evident when we consider simple cases a bit later. The point is these equations are essentially equivalent if you have a total, in an alpha squared dynamo where the large scale field grows relatively force free, the evolution of the large scale magnetic helicity is essentially equivalent to the evolution of the large scale magnetic field. And so your equations that you couple together to understand the saturation in this paradigm of tracking the magnetic helicity are these two. In general, when you have shear, there's a significant component of the field which is non-force free. You need to solve the evolution equation of the mean field and couple that into the evolution of the small scale helicity. As a general principle, what's happening is that by building up the large scale field, a significant component, and sometimes maybe not an energetically significant component if you have shear, but there's a significant component of the large scale field that will be helical. And because magnetic helicity is a conserved quantity, you're always generating the small scale magnetic helicity as a consequence. And it's the consequence of the buildup of the small scale magnetic helicity that actually slows the growth in when you look at what the generalized version of a mean field alpha type dynamo, this buildup of small scale helicity comes back and quenches you. And that's essentially the underlying principle. You don't get large scale fields for free, and it's not the small scale magnetic energy that kills you, but the small scale magnetic helicity. And alleviating the quenching, getting rid of the quenching, is a matter of getting rid of this small scale magnetic helicity. That's where the boundary terms can enter in a realistic system. And such. Given that the dynamo growth is typically driven by the EMF, you can see that you can have the EMF sourced also directly by boundary terms. And so that's another way of thinking about it. What happens at the boundary sources the EMF, and that can, you know, allow you to continue to grow your field. And in systems that we consider astrophysical systems, the boundaries are there. I'll try to show this, how all these principles work together a bit better. Now, just to review, the tokamak dynamo, not really a view for many, but basic concept that was explained by Kerry Forrest, you start out with a toroidal field, you put in a toroidal electric field, and at a certain point, and by doing that, you also produce a poloidal magnetic field. So you essentially inject helicity into the system by doing this, twisting the field. And at a certain point, the system becomes unstable. While by injecting the twist in the magnetic field, by injecting the electric field, you're driving the system away from its relaxed state. And that produces instabilities, fluctuations, and EMF, which then relaxes the system back towards its relaxed state. And that response to the injection of the magnetic helicity, the relaxation, is the dynamo process which converts the essentially poloidal to toroidal, sustains your toroidal field. And in this way, it's a dynamo in a magnetically dominated environment, not amplified by flow, but it's a dynamo in the sense that the EMF is converting you from basically injecting smallish scale magnetic helicity to a kind of global larger scale helicity, or transports the magnetic helicity and reconfigures the field line to its relaxed state. Now, it's known dynamical relaxation systems, there is a steady state in which the systems seek to relax to, which is that which minimizes the energy. And that's a situation which takes the magnetic helicity to the largest scale available to it, subject to the boundary conditions. And that's so the dynamo in this context is a relaxation process. You inject small-scale magnetic helicity, you inject magnetic helicity to the boundary, and it's redistributed to give the field that configuration. Now, these were sort of shown, and the offset between the imposed electric field and the resistive a current, and this difference can be in regions that are outside a, sort of a critical radius. This picture works well. That the fluctuation component in the EMF it provides you with the offset that's needed. Now, in particular, what I want to point out here, though, is that from those equations that I had before, you can take a limit of those equations, those very equations, and get the essence of the tokamak dynamo. This is a theme that has been sort of done in these papers, not thinking about the astrophysical case, but the equation of helicity. And basically what's going on is that there's a gap in the torus, and the potential drop across that gap times the flux is the quantity that's injected as magnetic helicity into the system. So there's a potential gap that is externally imposed, and that drives a flux of magnetic helicity, small-scale magnetic helicity, and that sustains your electromotive force. And you can, with some sort of thinking through this, show that the direction of the small-scale magnetic helicity flux acts to kind of homogenize the overall helicity gradient. This is the scale associated with the large scale J dotted with the mean field, gives you a 1 over the characteristic scale of the large scale field. And sustaining this balance requires essentially a flux of small scale helicity to propagate in the direction of where this quantity is decreasing. In other words, it acts to basically homogenize the helicity gradient. Now, an imperfect picture of this. This is not exactly, obviously, the P, but this is a kind of sense in which you have a small-scale thing and you're relaxing to a more global-scale structure. This is a unrelaxed, injected thing. This is the kind of a relaxed state, the twist you can sort of think of as relaxing. And by the way, helicity is a measure of twist and linkage. Now, that's an example, a known example where helicity flux is a metaphor for the sustenance of the EMF. There's no alpha, there's no kinetic helicity, no nothing else. And now you can sort of see where this is going in the context where you have other starting conditions. This flux can play a role, but you may also have the this is another example of the magnetic case. Helicity is injected is in a sort of a spheromak as opposed to a tormak. This is designed to set up to mimic something like the formation of a jet, in the sense that this is the first panel in each thing, and it evolves like this. And these are different amounts of twist that you inject. This was by Bellin and Hsu. The idea is they don't really talk about dynamos here, but the idea is it is a dynamo, in the sense that I just described, in that you inject magnetic helicity, essentially twisted structure on small scales. There's a relaxation process which occurs, takes the structure to large scales, and you get a kind of jet out of it. And that it can be described in along the lines of what I just described, injection of a small scale magnetic helicity evolving to a large scale, and also, of course, analogous to the astrophysical jet case. So that's case one, a magnetically dominated system in which the helicity flux allows us to understand how the large-scale field evolves. Now, and by the way, I considered that in a steady state, as you notice, this is sort of steady state, you have injection that's continuously going on, the system reaches some saturation, although, as Kerry Forrest knows and described better than I, just that the system actually doesn't reach an exact steady state, you get sawtooth oscillations, for example, but in a rough sense, the system maintains some kind of equilibrium. Now, this is a second case, and a very different problem, but we're going to see the role of the same combination of equations entering to understand how this goes. This is a forced, this is a situation forced, and this type of simulation was first done by Axel, 2001. Take a box, force it with helical turbulence, strictly forced, very idealized, but force it at a wave number k equals 5, and it's hydrodynamic now, it's a flow-dominated initial case. With a weak seed field, ask what happens to the magnetic energy spectrum as a function of time. And what Jason Marin and I did was to look at the same concept, only varying the amount of kinetic helicity that you inject the system with. So you inject with and compare that. So the usual small-scale dynamo problem that people study is where you inject with no kinetic helicity, just inject with random turbulence, ask what happens to the spectrum. That produces a magnetic spectrum of this sort. We take the same box, only now, again, still forcing at k equals 5, vary the fractional helicity. In the case where it's maximal, the saturated magnetic spectrum looks like this. So two things happen to this spectrum. A large-scale field grows, and a small-scale field sort of ends up peaking more robustly at the forcing scale. A two-scale system emerges out of this in the nonlinear state. And so the question is, well, first of all, this demonstrates that there is, in this simple system, a dynamo. One would like to understand how fast it grows. Can you model what the simulations show, etc.? I go to the helicity equations. In this case, the large-scale field. This is very simple because the large-scale field is force-free, so we don't need to solve the magnetic. To model this, one can go right to the magnetic helicity of large and small scales. It's a closed periodic box. The boundary flux term, which was important in the last problem, is negligible here. It goes away. We look at the other terms, and now we have our EMF. The velocity flow is now relevant, so you need an equation for the small-scale magnetic field, small-scale velocity field. There's a closure that you can go through, a topic of debate, but this particular closure does not use the first-order smoothing approximation. It includes a kludge for the triple correlations. The upshot of doing that, and that's for this purpose of this talk, that's something we can talk about afterwards for those of you that have doubts about that, but the upshot is it produces a set of equations that look like this. Large scale magnetic helicity, forcing scale magnetic helicity, and if you inject the system with an imposed kinetic helicity, that's a constant. So now we have two scales. We can solve these equations and compare them to the evolution of the simulation. And this is what was done in sort of 2002. Later, Axel and I also did this in a case for Scheer. But this is to fit the what Axel had done in this paper. Axel had produced some empirical fit formula that were used to match the data that were produced in the simulation, not using, at that time, dynamical theory, but empirical fit formula. The solid lines here show the actual solution of these two equations for different magnetic Reynolds numbers. And so the magnetic Reynolds number dependence on this evolution is included and manifest. This is the late time evolution to saturation. All of these features can be understood by analyzing those equations. The asymptotic saturation value is the same, independent of Reynolds number, but the rate that you get there to that steady state is different. And the whole issue is that it's about, in this case, you're forcing this velocity, kinetic helicity, but as you do this, that's also a source term for the small-scale magnetic helicity, which comes back into your equation for your large-scale magnetic helicity and eventually quenches. And so you can see that forcing with this grows this, which shuts this down. Ultimately, this goes to a steady state. You get a regime where you grow resistively because the wave number for the small schematic elasticity is a bit larger. So that gets you a little extra dissipation of a small scale elasticity, which dissipates a little faster than large scale. But eventually, you get up to a value of the large scale magnetic elasticity for which this is equal to zero, and these are also equal to zero, and the whole system reaches a steady state. Now you say, of course, in the simulations, the dotted lines were used to fit the asymptotic regime. If you extend those formula, and in that paper, the early time regime was not fit by Axel. So if you just use those and you extend them down to the kinematic regime, predicted by the theory of those two equations, the theory predicts that those three quantities merge up to a point and then start to diverge. Now, when you force in this way, there's an early kinematic phase and then it diverges. Now, the asymptotic thing is fit very well. This region, there is some work to be done to have time resolution in the simulations where you can robustly distinguish this early time kinematic regime before it trifurcates here. This only trifurcates because I have three different magnetic Reynolds numbers, and to see this difference. But the asymptotic evolution is certainly well matched by those equations, and one expects that. There is some at present whether this kinematic regime looks exactly like this, and I think there's some simulation needs to be to really pin that down a bit better, which requires higher simulations. But the point of this is there's several issues here. One is that I'm going to tell you that so you could argue that the kinematic regime gets you up to a certain amount of point. It turns out that at the kinematic regime you get a significant amount of magnetic mean field energy, the turbulent FHVT, F is the fractional helicity, kinetic helicity in this case that you force with. K1 over K2 is the ratio of the wave number of large scale, which is 1 in this case, and K2 is 5. So, depending on your parameters, this is already a significant number. The rest of the theme of this talk is I'm going to give our ways of alleviating this regime altogether. So, this is a kinematic regime, and one may say, okay, if a given application, even if you say there is this kinematic regime in this early time, but you want to avoid this late time regime. For more complicated dynamos with shear and such, I'm going to show more of that and how the helicity fluxes, in particular, alleviate this sort of saturation thing. But the key point of this, among the lessons that we learned from this, are that you have a theory now which matches well a simple, albeit idealistic, simulation in some key characteristics. So this is what has motivated further augmentation of use of this helicity equations to more general. It's in units of the forcing time of the eddy turnover forcing time. This is a long time. This is a very long time. Yeah. This time scale here. The kinematic regime predicted in this simulation is the time scale, and which is shown in this, is the time scale for the large scale magnetic helicity to equal the magnetic helicity in units of the forced kinetic helicity. And after that point, that's when your quenching really starts to kick in. Now, one point I just want to make, and I never really discussed this particular paper, but I also did with the model I showed before, the two-scale model, I've also done a three-scale model to try to understand whether or not the small-scale magnetic helicity piles up at the forcing scale or at a smaller scale if you allow it to do that at a smaller scale. This ties in a little bit with what Stas was saying, and what I did find is that, and of course this is very crude compared to a full spectral calculation, but I did find that at early times, the two-scale model very early times doesn't quite work in this paradigm, and what you find is that the current helicity at least first goes to the smallest scale but very quickly goes back up to the forcing scale. It's as if there's a dual relaxation process going on in this system. the very large scale field relaxes to the box scale available to it, which is k equals 1. The small scale magnetic helicity that you drive, it tries to pump downward, but then it inverse transfers back up to the forcing scale. So you have this kind of doubly peaked equilibrium once the end of the kinematic regime ensues. And so I looked at just by the end of the fast growth regime, and it seemed that in the three-scale model, it converges to a two-scale model just before the end of the three-scale. That's something that is maybe more of a subtle point, but question that often arises about the multi-scale. So lessons from the alpha squared in the periodic box, the coupling of small-scale magnetic helicity and ultimately the theory, another way of writing the theory, and this is a formula that Axel also had written down, is a time evolution of alpha. And so you have alpha as a function of time evolution quantities. You have a flux term, which in this problem was zero, but not in the, in this problem was zero. And turbulent diffusion, et cetera, et cetera. And so you can see that alpha, this is the kinematic alpha, by the way, which in this problem was forced as kinetic helicity. But you see that this is not the only term, and it's a time evolving quantity, even in the simple alpha squared. Now, an interesting thing, and this is along the theme of interpretation rather than challenging particular results, is that this reduces to the quenching that had been put forth in some time ago and thought in some sense to quench the dynamo. So in other words, if you immediately from the outset take away J, you take away the flux, and you take away time dependence, you have an alpha which is your expected kinematic alpha suppressed by the magnetic Reynolds number. So this more general formula reduces to all these cases under the conditions in which they were studied. And so that's a point. So the kinematic regime that I described is not necessarily enough, and one would like to, so if there is this kinematic early time regime, one would like to avoid this and ask, for example, you know, if you have cycle periods, you don't want the cycle period in the sun to be limited by resistively limited, you want it to be dynamically limited. How can you generalize further the lessons learned from here? And so alleviating this small-scale magnetic helicity buildup, which is the cause of this quenching, is the key to avoid the catastrophic question. Okay. So what? Okay. Okay. And the key, so one of the important points that has emerged is so if you learn just that about this, and that's important, but the one of the keys that has emerged from this is boundary terms. So early on, I did a kludgy thing, which was to take those two-scale models and just arbitrarily put in an extra term that loses small-scale magnetic helicity, and obviously that does lead to a growth of the large scale magnetic helicity at larger saturation values. But the more detailed work on understanding the role of boundary terms in increasingly more realistic is being done in simulations, and Axel is playing an important role in this. One of the lessons to include helicity flux and shear, there is a flux that's associated with shear flow. So now we're talking about dynamos, helical dynamos, either forced or natural, that allow for boundary terms. And there's a flux which goes along the surfaces of constant shear. There's also been an advective flux proposed by Shukharov et al. In the context of galactic, and it's been used in the context of galactic fountain flows of this sort. Both, this is a small-scale current helicity. Now these fluxes, when put into when understood, looking at the numerical simulations, interpreting them in general, several classes of these simulations support that the small-scale helicity fluxes do facilitate fast action when the shear is present. When only the boundaries are there and not the shear, you don't see this effect. First is Brandenburg and Sadin. Vishniak flux seem to be aiding the simulation of the shear flow with and without kinetic helicity. They forced with either. And the dynamo seemed to be sustained by the flux consistent with this that propagates out the boundaries. a more recent example, Kapla et al., in a more natural setting, convection plus shear, surfaces of constant shear aligned toward the open boundaries, that is something that they emphasize as a difference between that and paper by Tobias et al. Doing a similar calculation, which did not see the dynamo under similar conditions. But in that case, the shear under which one of these key fluxes, helicity flux that you have to calculate should flow, was in the plane and pointing towards periodic boundaries, not towards the open boundaries. And that seemed to be an essential ingredient. Now, so I'm going to just finish by giving this picture, which summarizes some of the concepts. And this is an old picture now, but wanted to just give some insight into what might be missing from the textbook and how to understand this in terms of the field lines, not just the equation. So in the standard textbook, you see a kinematic dynamo, which is really a kinematic dynamo. You see the field line treated as a line, and the field is twisted, and this is the usual amplification. You have differential rotation, et cetera, here. If you instead think of the field as a ribbon, because of the magnetic helicity conservation, as you produce a writhe in the large scale twist, which is in this case right-handed, you produce a twist along the flux rope, which is the opposite. And that ultimately makes the line harder to bend. And getting rid of this twist by ejecting it out of the system, coronal mass ejections, for example, irreversible in the solar corona, is a way of getting rid of this small scale helicity. And let me stop there. So, okay.
Do you or anybody have a physical interpretation of this Vishniak-Cho flux?
Yes. The Vishniak-Cho flux is one. There is one. It's in their paper. That particular flux is a little, in my mind, I don't have an immediate physical picture of that flux. But that being said, I think it's just not a matter of having tried in that case. It's just I just haven't tried to put the particular flux together in that physical picture. But there is a diagram. I agree. But it's still out of the word.
Just because there's an empty slot here, it's important to realize that it's a transport of small-scale magnetic helicity, this Vishniak and Cho flux, so not the overall. The overall magnetic helicity, of course, is described by the actual mean field induction equation.
Okay, yeah.
So it's always difficult with these pictures, and as you say, we should all try harder. And easily, such pictures are wrong, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I
would not be put too much weight into that, but certainly there's an underdimensional coefficient in front of this in this formula, and that needs to be calculated much more accurately. We don't know whether it's 0.1, 0.2, or even bigger than 1.
One thing I would say is that I think that the physical pictures are useful because they help. I mean, they are useful both for people working in the field, but also because it's something to go to help. Attract and make a broader audience at least understand what's going on. I mean, the visualization of the field lines is something that is maybe a frontier in this business, and it is useful to look at the visualization of field lines. Also, about the large and small scale helicity fluxes, one of the things in a real system you don't know, in this example, you actually eject here, you sort of eject some large scale helicity flux and some small scale helicity flux as well. The large scale helicity flux, in some sense, hurts your saturation value of the field in the interior because you're getting rid of exactly the thing that you want to generate. So in a real system, you would like to know in general what the relative fraction of the small and large scale helicity fluxes are. And it could be that although you keep a cycle period fast, the value that you saturate in the interior is lower than it would otherwise be if you didn't eject.
Exactly the question I wanted to ask you. We know in the sun, and we have discussed that with Axel, when you have CMEs, we have some evidences. I'm not sure they are all helical, but you do see, and it seems that it's large-scale magnetic helicity that has been, thrown away. And so, where here you seem to imply that it will be actually the small-scale magnetic helicity, which is key. So that it's important for me to.
I would say that in the case of the sun, my sense would be that. So the way I would describe what would happen if you eject, I would say that for here, in some of these pictures, there's an ambiguity as to what sign, for example, of the helicity is injected in each hemisphere. And I think there is a multiplicity of helicities on different scales. Let's assume, for example, that both large and small scale helicity are ejected, and I don't know exactly in what fraction. But I do think that what that would do, there's two issues. One is how large can the field be that you saturate at, the mean field? And the other is, how fast does the cycle period change between those fields? And I think the changing of the cycle period would depend on the ejection of the small scale, and the saturated value of the large scale field in the interior would be lowered by ejecting large scale field. That itself may not be a problem. In other words, we don't know what the field would be in the interior anyway if the field were trapped, since we only have what we have. So I think in general, in a given application, you can get a combination of effects. If you eject only the small scale field, then you win in all categories. You raise the saturated field of the large scale field, and you also keep it fast. If you eject both, then you can keep, so it's a combination of those two things.
I think I've just got one question, actually. In your analysis, you had the small scales and the large scales. We're hearing this morning that often there is no sharp distinction between small scales and large scales. I mean, under those circumstances, can you sort of generalize your approach in any way?
So when Stas, for example, was talking about that in the kinematic regime, and not inconsistent with the three-scale model that I started to see, that there was power appearing on a third scale in the very, very early times. But the interesting thing in these contexts is that in the non-kinematic regime, after the very early time, the simulations do show an emergence of two preferred scales, and so it seems that, oddly enough, it may be that a transition into what we were hearing today was a early time kinematic regime. It may be that the nonlinear effects actually conspire to saturate the field at small scale, lock it up, and you end up with the dynamics really occurring on a larger set of preferential
systems. So you have a picture in which the two scales emerge through nonlinear interactions.
Not crazy, yeah.
Okay,
one more comment here regarding small and large scales. I mean, in the alpha square dynamo, it's clear that we have to eject that we will eject both a large scale and small scale current helicity. For an alpha-omega dynamo, the fraction of large-scale helicity that is being ejected is far less clear. And nobody has actually observed this for the sun. What has been observed is what I would call the small scale. I would call it small scale because it is of negative sign. But it is the actual scale is still rather big. If you look in even in magnetic clouds in the solar wind, they all have negative helicity, and I would classify this as being part of the small scale. I mean, small scale has to be seen with respect to the large scale of the solar cycle, which has an 11-year dependence and which has, on the scales of the sun, a complete azimuthal symmetry and a width and latitude of 300 megameters. So that's really big compared to this tiny active region, which has even 30 megameters. So
but of course the only
it's a relativation of what is large and small.
I mean, I think there's room for interpretation about what's actually being ejected from the sun. Even the sign of what the net is, what the scale is, how that relates to the interior. I mean, in these structures, for example, what they're saying is that what one sees is that the, S-shaped or N-shaped N outnumbers S-shaped in the northern hemisphere by 60 to 40. But if you look along these structures, you see left-handed twists and such. The question of what in the surface actually corresponds to the large scale in the interior is a subtle question, I think. And I mean, obviously, there's room for discussion on that.
Okay. Well, that's the first time I've heard about rising field lines. I enjoyed that bit too.
Okay.
Thank you very much.